the videotape takes a certain amount of time. And then if we're going to talk about either Fanny Kemble or the making of the videotape, we want to have a little time. And I should explain, I think, first how I became intrigued with her and what being intrigued with her led to. I work in theater, and I was looking for some material to use just to do a little skit kind of thing, like a little 20-minute skit. And I lived in Seattle. I had just moved to Seattle, and I was working directing a show. So I wanted just to have something for myself to work on. So I went to the public library, and I just started going through the biographies in alphabetical order. And I looked at Louisa May Alcott, and I looked at Una Johnson, and you know, a number of these, your daughters?
Yeah.
Hi, come on in. Let me give you a program which I have now. So I was just explaining first how I became intrigued with Fanny Kemble and how this project developed. And then we'll watch this videotape. And then I can answer any questions you have. You know, what I'm doing and Fanny Kemble, whatever you want to talk about, either the making of the videotape or Fanny Kemble herself. So I was looking for material, this was about 10 years ago, and I was looking for material just on somebody to do a theater piece on. I work in theater, and I just wanted to find some true, real person, historical person, that I could work on. And so I was looking through the public library and just going in alphabetical order. And I wasn't finding anybody, and I got to the K's, and there was a book by Fanny Kemble. And I had known a little bit about her because I had lived in a part of Massachusetts where she lived. She lived in Lenox, Massachusetts, in western Massachusetts, and I had lived just north of there in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And I knew that there was a Kemble Street. And I had also lived in Philadelphia, where she had lived. And I knew that she was an actress. And I knew that she wrote a number of autobiographical books, but I'd never read any of them. So I took one out of the library. She was a 19th century actress, known for playing Shakespeare. So I took out one of her autobiographical books. And it started out by saying, "There has been so much gossip written about me that I feel that it is time that I now reaped some of the benefits of these stories by writing my own." And I thought that was pretty funny. And so then I read that book, and that was just a very funny and delightful and amusing book about her growing up in England. So I started to read, you know, more of her own writings. And in the course of that, I came upon this book. Well, at first I got the library one. And this is Journal of a Residence on a Georgian Plantation. And what happened in her life, I had really followed by that time, because she had been born into a very well-known English theatrical family, very famous theatrical family. Her aunt was Sarah Siddons, who was supposed to have been the best actress who ever lived, English-speaking actress. And her family all worked in theater. She had been very, very famous as a young woman when she first started to act, when she was 19. And she was sort of like, she was kind of like Elizabeth Taylor and kind of like Jane Fonda. She was very outspoken, everybody liked her, she knew a lot of politicians, she knew a lot of royalty, she knew a lot of writers. Her brother was a leading intellectual, and she actually put him through college because it was her earnings that put him through college. He became the first professor of Anglo-Saxon at London University. She knew everybody. And if she didn't know somebody, she could easily get to know that person. When she came to this country, she came here with her father, and she was simply working here as an actress to earn money because the family had fallen into terrible debt through a series of circumstances that have a lot to do with the legal system in England and are very complicated. So she and her father came here to earn money, and they toured in the United States, that is what was then the United States, which is just the eastern seaboard, really. They would go, the two of them, to a theater company in Baltimore or Philadelphia or New York or Washington. And they would take the two leading roles in a play, and the resident company would support them. So they did all the Shakespeare plays and a number of other contemporary 19th century sort of melodramatic plays. She was very popular, again, in this country. And she had a number of beaux and people who sent her flowers and took her riding, which she liked to do. Took her to parties. One of the people who escorted her around was a man named Pierce Butler, who just started following them, just started following the Kembles. And indeed, he sometimes played the flute when they performed. There would be a house orchestra wherever they performed, played the flute. Well, eventually he won her heart and married her. And she got off the stage, which she was very glad to do because she had never liked acting anyway. She liked writing and she didn't like acting. So she was very glad to get off the stage. She gave all her earnings to her father, who then had enough money so that he could settle the debts and he could retire if he wanted to. And she went to live in Philadelphia. After she was married to Pierce Butler, she learned that he owned slave plantations. She also learned that he wasn't necessarily the gentle man that she had assumed he was. By the time she married him, she was, it was 1834 that she married him, and she was born in 1809, so she was 25. By the time she married Pierce Butler, she'd already published a number of books. She'd published a very bad play called Francis the First. She had published some reminiscences. She'd published some poetry. And while she was traveling in the United States doing that tour, she had kept a journal which she intended to publish. And it was her observances of life in the United States. And it's very funny. I mean, she says very funny things. She was very candid. She said she thought American women's voices were terrible because they were too loud and brash and high-pitched. She thought American dinner parties were an utter bore because all that happened was that men talked about business. She said a number of things which ring true. That book has just been republished by Columbia University, and for the first time in this publication, all the names are named. In the original edition, which was published, she had cut out all the names, but this was just published this year. They were very, she knew everybody. I mean, she went to the White House and chatted with President Jackson and had dinner with Daniel Webster and John Quincy Adams. And Washington Irving was a great family friend, and so, you know, she had a lot of fun. But her observations on American life were somewhat critical, and her husband didn't want her to publish the book. She did include in that original manuscript of that book a reaction to slavery. She had not seen it firsthand because she hadn't been in the Deep South. But she had, soon after she was married, she had learned that her husband owned plantations, and that came as a great surprise. She and her husband were both, her husband was a Unitarian, and she went with him to the Unitarian Church. The Unitarian Church was, you know, liberal then as it is now, and was quite anti-slavery as an entity, but that didn't affect him. So she did include in the manuscript of that journal of, what did she call it? Journal of a Young Actress. She did include a statement that was an anti-slavery statement, but her husband talked her out of it, and so that statement was eliminated from the manuscript. And the book that was published was really, it would be as if Vanessa Redgrave wrote a book about touring in the United States, and she'd be very critical of a lot of things, as you can imagine. And a lot of people would buy it because it would be an actress writing these observations. And the difference is that Fanny Kemble was very young. Her husband was very embarrassed and didn't like the idea that it was published, but it was published. She obviously had made clear her anti-slavery statements to her husband, and she wanted to go and see the plantations. And he didn't want her to go. But finally she prevailed. And so in 1838, she went to see the plantations and wrote this book. Now this is where the television program starts. What happened to me was, once I read this book, I realized that I had more than a 20-minute piece, that I had a full-scale play, because there really is a dramatic story of what happened to her when she went to Georgia, saw what happened on the plantations, what happened to her marriage as the result, and to her life. And so I wrote a play that was about all of that. After I was doing that play, the Georgia State University got in touch with me. They were doing they wanted to do a television series on the whole Pierce Butler family in Georgia, but they ended up only doing one television program, and they wanted me to work on it. And it was to center on Fanny Kemble. So I went with them and worked with them on it. And we actually used my play script as the basis for the television script. And we went to the places in Georgia where the events had taken place almost 150 years before the time that we made it. So this is the television program, and I'll be happy to answer any questions about the television program. Sound in this isn't as good as it should be, and so I'll try to fool around with it. But if we miss something and you want to know what was said afterwards,
how long is this?
It's a half an hour, and it was shown on PBS and is now shown in schools and libraries.
Because I'm on lunch duty, so I'm going to have to leave.
Okay.
So if she disappears, you know.
Okay. I know you didn't just get fooled.
Yeah. Okay.
And when I made this, I was using my married name professionally. I was using the name O'Connell. Okay. And so that's what it's listed as.
The following program was produced by the Office of Educational Media at Georgia State University.
And sweet airs that give delight and hurt not. Sometimes a thousand twangling instruments will hum about my ears, and sometimes voices. I'm Fanny Kemble. English born and English died. From the most English of English theatrical families, the Kemble-Siddons family. I made my theatrical debut as Juliet in Romeo and Juliet, the Covent Garden Theatre in London in 1829. I was a great success. I saw shop windows filled with sketches of me, saucers with pictures of me on them. Gentlemen wore buff-coloured handkerchiefs with lavender silhouettes at my head, and ladies wore Kemble curls. Alas, fame is not the same as fortune. The promise of American box office receipts lured me and my father across the great dividing ditch of the Atlantic Ocean for a tour of the northern cities. The New York Evening Post said that I was perfect, that a more brilliant performance had never been seen on the New York stage, and that my presence would raise and refine the American style. People flocked to see me. We went to New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston. They cheered and they showered the stage with roses. Wherever I performed, a handsome Philadelphia gentleman followed me. He attended every performance. He waited at the stage door. He took me riding. He sent me nosegays. It was the golden time of my existence. In the spring of 1834, I gave over my American earnings for the support of my parents in their old age. I announced my decision to leave the stage and to marry my Philadelphia friend, Mr. Pierce Butler. I knew he was not intellectually brilliant, but I found him charming, and I thought his moral faculties were excellent and strong. Soon after my marriage, my husband inherited extensive rice and cotton plantations at the mouth of the Altamaha River in the Sea Islands of Georgia. The family into which I married were large slaveholders. When I married Pierce Butler, I knew nothing of these possessions. I had an English woman's prejudice against slavery, but I expected to find much kindness on the part of the master and much contentment on the part of the slaves. At my earnest entreaties, I visited these plantations. I traveled with my husband and our two baby daughters, Sally and Fan, and our faithful Irish nursemaid, Marjorie O'Brien, in the winter of 1838. As we neared the low, reedy banks of Butler Island, the steersman took up a huge conch. In the barbaric fashion of ancient times, sounded out our approach. From the sedges, a profusion of waterfowl started up. Now the war, a crowd of negroes jumped and danced. They clapped their hands and whistled and cried out, "Massa, massa, how you do? Oh, missy, me so glad to see you." I believe I was almost afraid. Our domain contained several thousand acres. The whole island was really swamp, surrounded by dikes. It was said to be one of the largest rice plantations in America. On all sides lay the marshy rice fields and swampy patches of yet unreclaimed forest. huge cypress tree and exquisite green undergrowth sprang up from stagnant, sweltering pools. Here, the magnolia grew to the size of a forest tree. Amphibious creatures, alligators, serpents, and a profusion of bird life, mockingbirds and blackbirds, and scarlet and indigo birds I couldn't name. And then the sky, the unspeakable glories of these southern heavens. There was no master's dwelling, as no master had been in residence for over two generations. And in consequence, we inhabited the cottage used by our overseer. It consisted of three rooms, one for sitting and eating, one for our bedroom, and an attic chamber for Margie O'Brien and the babies. It was devoid of conveniences and adornments. Such being our abode, there was little danger of my being dazzled by the splendors of a southern slave residence. First morning, the overseer presented our servants to us, those who had been selected to wait upon us in the house. Our housekeeper, Molly, known as Old House Molly, to distinguish her from all of the other Mollies on the estate, and our cook, John, quite a tolerable one he was too, I do believe it is a natural talent among them, and our footmen, waiters, two lads, 15 or 16 years old, Hector and Alexander. When I first met them, their faces and hands and clothes and naked feet were so encrusted with dirt that their attendance on our table was not particularly agreeable to me. A young woman named Psyche, commonly known as Sack, served as a sort of a under-nursemaid, an assistant to our Marjorie. The presence of Margie O'Brien caused considerable confusion on Butler Island. The people had no idea of a white person performing any of the duties of a servant. They spoke of her as the other missy. And me? As the right missy. There were no sleeping quarters in our house for our house slaves. On southern plantations, servants never slept under the same roof with their masters. If duties required their attendance at sick bed or cradle, they were permitted to pass the night on the floor. Nor were there any accommodations for their meals in our house. No time, no place was set aside for them to eat. Consequently, they congregated at all hours in the cooking shed, where they stood or squatted by the fire, picking at whatever was left from the master's table. With the exception of our house servants, the slaves were divided into gangs, such was the honorable term. There were gangs of field hands, who were the majority, and gangs of artisans who were exceedingly expert at their trades. There was a gang of bricklayers, and a gang of blacksmiths who made all of the iron implements for field and hearth that were used on the estate, and a gang of carpenters, and a gang of coopers, who made all of the wooden barrels that were used for our rice crop. Oh, and they also made wonderfully fragrant cedar tubs and buckets for the use of the people. Cooper, London, the head cooper, was the people's preacher. The people on this plantation were not permitted to go to the mainland for church except once a month. And on the other Sundays, they assembled at Cooper London's cabin, where he led them in prayer and read the Bible to them. There are three camps on the island. Each consists of a dozen or so cabins and a cook shop where the daily rations are boiled in huge cauldrons. Soon after my arrival, I called at one of the cabins. I entered the main room. It was about 12 by 15 feet, with two tiny closets for sleeping. Two families, two large families, one of 7 people and one of 10 people, resided in it. A group of half-naked children, all with babies on their backs, cowered around 2 or 3 cinders. When the mothers are in the field, the older children act as little nurses. They watch over the babies and carry them to the mothers to be nourished. I proclaim to all the little nurses that I would give 1 cent to each child whose baby's face should be clean, and 1 cent more to each child with clean hands and face of his or her own. My appeal was fully comprehended by the majority. And subsequently, whenever I emerged from my front door, I was surrounded by swarms of children, the little charges on their backs, all with shining, and in many cases still wet, faces and hands. Thus did I ingeniously contrive to introduce bribery and corruption into the island. The steel-driven machine which shelled the rice was under the supervision of a slave named Ned, Engineer Ned. Ned was an uncommonly youthful-looking man. He attributed his appearance to never having been exposed to brutish field work. At the head of each field gang was a black driver. The task system was in force, and each day the driver assigned a task to each man and woman under him. The tasks were professed to be graduated according to sex, age, and strength, but in practice, the men and women had the same burdens, a noble admission of female equality. The head driver was Headman Frank. When the overseer was absent from the estate, as he frequently was, Headman Frank was sole governor of the island. He appointed the work, he pronounced punishments, he exercised undisputed mastery over his fellow slaves, yet he remained just as much a slave as any of the rest. Under the law, he could be flogged by the overseer, or sold like a cart horse by the master. I often saw him looking over the broad river, which was for him as a prison wall. The man Frank's wife was Betty, a tiny, trim, sad-looking woman with a pretty figure. And their youngest son was Renty, a lad with a light complexion and a decided air of superiority. The overseer was a man of extraordinary energy and activity. He was the only white man living on the island, and he directed the destinies of 700 slaves. The slaves on this estate consider themselves well off. They're not hired up to other masters, they're not bought and sold, members of families are not parted for life, they're not brutally beaten. The rules of punishment on Butler Island had been laid down many years before by Pierce's grandfather. In the field, the driver was allowed to inflict 12 lashes upon any refractory slave at the time of the offence. The headman had the power to inflict 36 lashes at his own discretion, the overseer up to 50, and as for the master, there were no limits. The slaves on this estate are regularly fed 2 meals a day, rice and corn grits. They're provided with clothing. Every year, each slave is given 2 pairs of shoes and several yards of flannel. They're given tolerable habitation, and there's an infirmary for their care. As soon as I learned there was an infirmary, I determined to visit it at once. The infirmary was a large barn-like building of whitewashed wood. The enormous fireplace glowed, powerless embers of a few sticks, and some 24 women huddled about it. They lay prostrate on the floor without bed or mattress or pillow. Some expected it every hour, the agonies of childbirth. and some groaned from the anguish of miscarriage. Some had just brought their doomed offspring into the world. I stood in the midst of them, perfectly unable to speak. The tears poured from my eyes. When I recovered myself, I addressed old Rose, the midwife in charge of the room, and I bade her open the shutters of such windows as were glazed. I then proceeded to make up the fire. But upon my lifting a log, there was a universal outcry of horror. Let alone, missy! Let be! What for you lift log, missy? You got nigger nothing! Ill herself, she was nursing a sick baby. I addressed remonstrances to her about the horribly dirty condition of her child, and she assured me she had not time to keep any of her children clean. But she went out to work at daybreak and did not complete her task until night, and then she was too worn out to do anything but throw herself down and sleep. I left this refuge for our sick dependents with my clothes filled with dirt and filled with vermin. I returned home, and I described my chagrin to Pierce and to the overseer. The overseer told me that the condition of the infirmary had appeared to him to require reform, and he had proposed it. But receiving no encouragement, had assumed it was a matter of indifference to the owners. I mentioned Charlotte's statement about not having time to keep her babies clean. The overseer assured me it was not true. The next day, I went again to the infirmary, and there had indeed been some faint attempt at cleaning the place. Charlotte, however, was crying bitterly. When I asked her what ailed her, she informed me, more by signs than words, that the overseer had flogged her. Why? For having complained to me that she had not time to keep her babies clean. After that, I went to the infirmary every single day. I bathed women and I washed babies. I removed fleas from black bodies and lice from woolly heads. I cleaned infected arms and legs, and I washed stumps of what had once been hands and feet. For exercise, I rowed a small boat, and on one occasion, I rowed to a remote settlement where some of the oldest slaves, those who would not die, were sent to be out of the way. One very aged woman spoke to me of Pierce's grandfather and of the early days of the plantation when she was young and strong. She told me that she still deserved to be kept. Oh, me no longer able to work, miss. I made plenty little nigger for you and master. She followed up this with a request for a bit of sugar.
Oh, dear.
Oh. I was constantly besieged by petitioners. In the house, no time, no place afforded me respite, and whenever I walked out, they surrounded me. Suki, Kwambo's wife, came to implore that the rule be altered which sends the women back into the field 2 weeks after they give birth. She had had 2 miscarriages, 4 children born, and all but her new baby were dead. Young Morris, the blacksmith, asked permission to be baptized. Betty, headman Frank's wife, had come with a similar request. She told me that she had several times asked the overseer for permission for the ceremony, and had never been able to obtain it. Dorcas, Bush's wife, came complaining of weakness in the back and incessant flooding. She asked that her field workload be lightened. I referred these requests to my husband, although he complained that I ought not listen to such trash from the darkies. Sarah, Stephen's wife, 2 miscarriages, crippled with rheumatism, was with child again. Chloe, Israel's wife, 3 miscarriages, 2 children born, 1 of whom died. Leah, Caesar's wife, 6 children born, 3 dead. Hannah, Abraham's wife, 2 miscarriages, with child again. Venus, Jack's wife, 6 children born.
Yeah, what is this I see? Cold ice hands all over me. He says, I am dead and no one can excel.
Many of the petitioners I was able to satisfy myself. Alec, Alexander, our waiter, came with a special request. Alec was an uncommonly bright lad, and under my tutelage he had become a first-rate footman. He asked me to teach him to read. I wanted to do it, but it would have been quite simply breaking the law. The penalties for teaching a slave to read were very severe. Heavy fines, imprisonment, even death. Unrighteous laws, however, are made to be broken. I did teach Alec to read. 20 came asking to be relieved of field work and to be allowed to learn a trade, citing his white blood. I said, what do you mean, Benty, your white blood? Who is your mother? Betty? Headman Frank's wife? Who is your father? The overseer? Did your mother tell you so? No. The other children told me. I suspect they know. Old Rose confirmed the story. And she told me of her granddaughter who had attempted to run away. Old Rose said, what born nigga run away? The small boy rats? They get in there. They starve to death. Will the snakes eat them up? Dresses nigga, they don't ever run away. Nurses nigga, they don't ever run away. I was getting perfectly savage at such things. I really thought I should consider my own throat and those of my children well cut if some night the people decided to clear off scores in that fashion. I wonder they do not rise up like Caliban and howl, farewell, master, farewell, farewell. No more dams I'll make for fish, nor fetch in firing. Requiring, nor scrape trench ring, nor wash dish. Bam, bam, cacao, bam. Got no master, got no man. Freedom, hiding, hiding, freedom, freedom, hiding, freedom. Shadrach was seized with pneumonia. The doctor came repeatedly from the mainland. One night, Mr. Butler himself watched with him. Shadrach sank rapidly, and after 3 days, he died. That evening, as twilight thickened into darkness, I went with Mr. Butler to the cabin of Cooper London. A large assemblage of the people had gathered outside around the coffin which lay on trestles. Many of the men carried pine torches, the fitful glare glancing over the strange assembly. The first high wailing notes of a hymn sung by the whole congregation sent a thrill through all my nerves. Cooper London proclaimed the everlasting covenant of freedom and of the resurrection of the life. All the people knelt. I felt awe and pity and wonder at finding myself on this soil, surrounded by my slaves, in the presence of the dead man and the living God. Mr. Butler alone remained standing. Some days later, Mr. Butler summoned me into his presence. He told me that niggers are all damn liars, and I was a fool to believe anything they told me. He refused to receive any more petitions through me, and he ordered me to listen to no more requests and to cease meddling in the business of the estate. I was not born among slaves, and I could not live among them, condemned to see and hear such misery without the means to alleviate it, without the right even to present it for alleviation. I then perceived that the physical misery of the slave has as counterpart the moral wretchedness of the master. I had seen what few Englishmen had ever seen, the workings of the slavery system from the midst of it. I considered it my duty to make known what I had witnessed. Mr. Butler presented to the Court of Common Pleas of the City of Philadelphia a prayer for absolute divorce from the bond of matrimony. He claimed that I frequently expressed abolitionist views, and that when it came to the publication of such sentiments, he must offer his unqualified opposition. The court granted the divorce. My journal of a residence on a Georgian plantation was published in London and in New York. What's past is prologue. What's to come is now in your discharge.
I'm on my way to Canaan. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way to Canaan land. I'm on my way, I'm on my way. If you don't go,
it's just too bad. It's only the three of us.
I know. Well, she's not known, you see. The book is in the bookstore. And it's actually a newer edition than the one I have, so that there's a little bit it's a little bit better because there's a little bit more information in the foreword about recent discoveries about what she said, for example, because for a long time, her book was dismissed. At the time that it came out, it was accepted, except by Southerners who said that she was just a wronged wife who was was venting her spleen. But recent historians dismissed it because she was an actress and they felt she couldn't be an accurate observer, which of course is nonsense because actors are very accurate observers. And also she was a trained musician, so she was the first person to write about black music mm-hmm. as a musician. But there has been more and more evidence that's come to light, partly through archaeological digs, that what she said was right. I mean, one of the things that historians said was, well, you see, she said that there were three or four slave communities on the island, and we know there weren't. There was only one. But recent archaeological digs and observations from airplanes and using the kind of infrared techniques they can now use in studying maps have shown, indeed, there were three, and they were exactly where she said they were, and they've now dug and they've found the things that she said were there. So,
I must say that also your portrayal of her, the way you...
Oh, wonderful. Yes.
Well, thank you. Really it was fun to do.
I feel so privileged.
Those are all her words, too. I mean, yeah. Except for The Tempest. I've used some excerpts from The Tempest in this. She really thought in Shakespearean, and in her own writings, there are always quotes from Shakespeare all the way through, and I thought The Tempest was exactly the right play, too. It was her favorite play to use in this context. So the script is her words, sentences shortened and that kind of thing, and rearranged. It's not in the order that she wrote it in, but it's her words. Some of her stuff is just...